Welcome to God and Country Biblical Exposition. Last week in my radio program, I began to discuss Daniel chapter 9. And this week on the radio program is part 2 of that discussion. Most of the material I'm combining into this one YouTube. So let's get started. Why discuss Israel? Well, in the grand scheme of things, for all the attention Israel gets, Israel is a very tiny nation. There are only about 7 million Jews living in Israel and about 15 million Jews in the entire world. There are more people in Belarus or Guatemala or Mali, but you never hear of those nations. Because for unseen spiritual reasons, Israel is the focus of world attention. As the prophecy states, so it will be. Zechariah chapter 12, verse 3. It will come about in that day that I will make Jerusalem a heavy stone for all the peoples. All who lift it will be severely injured, and all of the nations of the earth will be gathered against it. Israel is and will continue to be the focus of world attention. Just last week, up the parkway from me in Jersey City, two gunmen killed three Orthodox Jews at a kosher supermarket. The details haven't emerged, but it looks like another anti-Semitic attack of terrorism. There is this inexplicable hatred for the Jewish people, a people who pretty much mind their own business, but this hatred is happening on a spiritual, demonic level. And let's remember that Jesus himself told us to keep an eye on Israel. In his Olivet Discourse, Matthew 24, we are to learn the parable of the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. So you too, when you see all of these things, recognize that he, the Messiah, the second coming, is near, right at the door. Now, this metaphor of the fig tree is not just a lesson that when leaves come out of a tree, that's a sign that summer is coming, that there are simply signs and harbingers of that which is to come. In the Bible, the fig tree is the symbol of Israel. One verse of many, Hosea chapter 9, verse 10, I saw your fathers as the earliest fruit on the fig tree in its first season. So when Jesus said, when you see the fig tree bud, he was saying that when you see Israel revived. And at the beginning of the Passion Week, Jesus cursed the fig tree because it had leaves but no fruit. Matthew chapter 21, verse 19, seeing a lone fig tree by the road, he came to it and found nothing on it except leaves. And he said to it, no longer shall there be any fruit from you. And at once the fig tree withered. Jesus was not retaliating against the fig tree because he was hungry. The cursed fig tree clearly represents Israel. It had leaves. It was thriving as a nation, but it had no fruit for God. And then later in the same week, Jesus tells the disciples, when you see the fig tree putting forth leaves, you know that my coming is near. Clearly a reference to Israel being restored before the end of this age, as prophesied in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27. And in the same message to the disciples, the Olivet Discourse, Jesus told his disciples to look for the future fulfillment of the prophecy of Daniel as a sign of the coming future apocalypse. Matthew 24, 15, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. So Jesus is directing his people to look for and understand Daniel's prophecy about the abomination of desolation. And where is that found? Well, Daniel chapter 9, the text that we're going to discuss in today's program. So this is why the church ought to look to Israel for signs of the time. This is not prophetic sensationalism. This is sound biblical exegesis. So let's look at a few news items before we get into our exposition, Daniel chapter 9. The first news item, Forbes magazine, Trump administration reverses 40 years of U.S. foreign policy on Israeli settlements, ruffling international feathers. On November 18th, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced that the Trump administration was reversing U.S. policy and will no longer view Israel's settlements in the West Bank as a violation of international law. Remember last year, Trump announced that the United States would recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, and he moved the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. This is something that previous presidents said they were going to do, but they never did it. Because once in office, the leftists at the State Department convinced the administration that such a move would upset the Muslim world. Trump didn't care what people thought. He just did what he felt was right. And the leftist news media went unhinged. Well, this year, Trump's gift for Israel is that the U.S. will now support Israeli construction on the West Bank. The U.S. will now say that the Jewish ownership of these lands is legitimate. You probably didn't hear much about this in the news, but this is huge, as Donald Trump would say. The previous U.S. policy of opposing Israel's construction on the West Bank was not something passed by Congress. The U.S. Constitution allows the president to set foreign policy. So in 1978, President Carter decided that Israeli building on the settlements on the West Bank was inconsistent with international law. When Ronald Reagan became president, he didn't believe that the settlements were inherently illegal. But then under President Obama, Secretary of State John Kerry directly stated that the Israeli settlements were illegal according to international law. But now under Trump, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, a truly Christian man, stated it shall henceforth be the policy of the United States that Israeli settlements, Jews living in the biblical heartland of Judea and Samaria, do not by their very existence violate international law. And the point is this. Israel has a right to the land based on the 1917 Balfour Declaration passed by the League of Nations, the 1922 Mandate for Palestine, the San Remo Conference, the UN Charter, Article 80, the Arab decision to refuse the UN's November 1947 partition plan, Israel's victory in 1967 and the 1973 wars, and the land that Israel is building on were never part of a sovereign state called Palestine, but were lands illegally occupied by Jordan. But because of anti-Semitism, many political voices have claimed that the Israeli settlements are a violation of international law. They just say it without any legal basis for the claim. They say it because of personal preference. But President Trump is no longer playing this game. He is overturning the leftist narrative. In the words of one pundit, Josh Hammer, this is a paradigm-altering and inspiring decision for which the Trump administration deserves effusive praise. It is manifestly correct, symbolic in its courageous defiance of the groupthink of the ubiquitous anti-Semitic international community, and stakes out a bold moral starting point in the long-standing fight for Judea and Samaria, which is ground zero in the fight for Western civilization itself. In left-leaning legal and political science academic circles, there is perhaps no more agreed-upon truth than the notion that Israel is an illegal occupier that flagrantly tramples all over Arab-Palestinian rights to sovereignty and self-determination. The Trump administration has just taken a jackhammer to that golden calf of ivory tower idolatry and has done so less than a week after the European Union's anti-Semitic decision to specifically label certain Israeli products made by Jews living in the biblical heartland of Judea and Samaria. Bravo. Truly. Unquote, Josh Hammer. One more story about Israel. Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, has been indicted on corruption charges. This is another story most people are not aware of. But there is this leftist element in Israel that is seeking to oust this conservative prime minister, Netanyahu, by making up corruption charges against him. In the same way that the left in America is trying to oust Donald Trump by making up fake corruption charges. The similarities are uncanny. There is a left in Israel that wants power. They control the press. They spread fake news to hurt the prime minister in the polling. Then they report the polling as if it were news to further the negativity. Like 51% of the Israelis want Netanyahu to resign. They abuse the legal system to work their corruption. They target their opponents, the livelihood of their opponents. They threaten witnesses. They invent crimes. They selectively leak to the media. And there's a leftist deep state in Israel, just like there is in the United States. It's like the left in the U.S. and the left in Israel have read the same playbook. To get power for yourself, you indict the leader that you want to get rid of, and you indict him with false accusations. This is Isaiah 29:20. Those who are the ruthless, who will come to an end. They are the scorners. They're intent on doing evil. And they cause a person to be indicted by a word and ensnare him who adjudicates at the gate and defrauds the one in the right with meaningless arguments. So here's what's happening in Israel. A coalition of Israeli politicians who want to take the power for themselves away from Netanyahu's coalition started the Blue and White Party in Israel. And one of the actors has pursued and charged Netanyahu on three charges of breach of trust and one bribery count. The charge is that positive press coverage was given to Netanyahu in exchange for Netanyahu doing a favor for this editor. Yet positive press coverage is never considered a campaign donation. Otherwise, every news outlet in the world would be prosecuted. But the opposition is using this as a pretext to indict the prime minister, even given the fact that the positive news coverage never even took place. So it's very similar to what's happening here in the United States against Trump. They're accusing him of withholding aid from Ukraine in exchange for an investigation of Hunter Biden, when in fact, Ukraine got the aid with no strings attached. In an article by Carolyn Glick, an avid conservative, defender of Israel, she writes the following. Netanyahu pledged to fight for his freedom and for the restoration of Israeli democracy and the rule of law. In his speech Thursday night, he made an impassioned appeal to his decent political rivals to join him in this fight. Netanyahu is being indicted for crimes that don't actually exist. The message is clear. Every politician is at the mercy of the prosecutors. Fall out of line and you will become a criminal suspect before you can say prosecutorial abuse. It's certainly true that the left shares the prosecutor's hatred of Netanyahu. Blue and white exist to destroy him. But all the leftist politicians and Lieberman who are celebrating today need to understand that the Netanyahu they love to hate is their best friend and defender today. If Netanyahu is found guilty of crimes that were invented for the purpose of destroying him, then their goose will be cooked along with his. Politicians may make us happy or sad, frustrated or infuriated, but today, in post-democratic Israel, it hardly matters. Netanyahu called last night for an investigation of the investigators. Unless our elected officials join forces to heed his call, they and the voters who elected them will never be relevant again. So Netanyahu is fighting those in Israel who want the power for themselves and are trying to get it through corruption. Yes, even in this persecuted, tiny little nation, the size of New Jersey, with a population of only 9 million, the ungodly are still driven by a thirst for power. And it reminds me a lot of the biblical account of Ahab and Jezebel. When Ahab wanted to take Naboth's farm for his own plantation, 1 Kings 21, so she, Jezebel, wrote letters in Ahab's name and sealed them with his seal and sent letters to the elders and to the nobles who are living with Naboth in his city. Now, she wrote in the letter saying, proclaim a fast and seat Naboth at the head of the people. And then seat two worthless men before him and let them testify against him saying, you curse God and the king, then take him out and stone him to death. And so the men of the city, the elders and nobles who lived in the city, did as Jezebel had sent word to them. So this is the age-old tactic of evil. Invent crimes against those you want to destroy. And notice how the elders in Israel went along with Jezebel's lie for their own political safety. Again, Isaiah 29, defrauding the one in the right with meaningless arguments. And this plot against Netanyahu is also a reminder of why the Jewish nation fell to the Babylonians in 586 BC. because of Israel's internal corruption, as we read about in the prophet Jeremiah, and explains why God took away Israel's freedom and put them under the Roman occupation during the days of the Maccabees. Because the Maccabean descendants were so power-hungry and corrupt, they destroyed the entire nation. And their hypocrisy is actually prophesied in Daniel chapter 11, verse 34, which is a story for another time. So let's just remember that God is orchestrating the return of the Jews back to Israel, not in their righteousness, but in their sin. Revelation chapter 11, verse 8 calls future restored Israel, Sodom and Egypt, where also their Lord was crucified. And that's the spiritual state of national Israel today. The majority of Israel is no friend of God, no friend of the Messiah. And it appears from the prophecies that much of national Israel will embrace the Antichrist when he arrives as a solution for world peace. Revelation chapter 11, the people of Israel despise the true prophets of God who are to come in the apocalypse. Then in Zechariah chapter 10, verse 9, God will whistle for the Jews, bring them back to Israel. Zechariah 12, 6, Israel will be put into the fire of affliction. Then chapter 13, verse 2, God will use this affliction to remove the unclean spirit from the land. Chapter 13, verse 8, two-thirds of Israel will perish, and only one-third will be brought through the fire. Refine them as silver is refined, and test them as gold is tested, and they will call upon my name. Israel, back in the land, still needs to be purged and refined and purified. The rebels will be removed, and God's elect will be converted. And this brings us to the prophecy of Daniel chapter 9, that the prophetic timetable for Israel is for the purpose of finishing the transgression, making an end to sin, to make atonement for iniquity, and to bring in everlasting righteousness. Although I'm speaking here about national Israel, those physical descendants of Abraham, who will be part of the true Israel of God, as Gentile believers, this text applies to us because, in a sense, we've been grafted in. Daniel 9:24 has an application for every place and every time. All that we're experiencing right now in our personal lives, in our national life, is meant to save and sanctify us, to finish our transgressions, to make an end to our sin, to make an atonement for our iniquity, and to bring in everlasting righteousness. Or as we read in the New Testament, 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 18, to rescue you from every evil deed and bring you safely into his heavenly kingdom. To him be the glory forever and ever. Amen. Now, at this point, I'm going long. I'm kind of losing my voice here because I picked up a little bit of a cold here in this damp New York City winter weather. I can't fully exposit Daniel chapter 9 in 10 minutes, but I can give an overview. And maybe a flyover is actually better, so we can get the big picture rather than being caught up in all of the weeds. So 70 weeks have been decreed for the Jews. 70 weeks means in the Hebrew 70 sevens, or seven groups of 70, or 490. It doesn't say whether these are hours or days or years. It just says 490. But it's assumed that it's referring to years because the whole exile and the whole context is based here upon years. The Jews were to be exiled to Babylon for 70 years. 1 year for every year they failed to follow the 7-year sabbatical rest. God will get the time that belongs to him one way or another. Jeremiah 25, verse 11, this whole land will be desolate and a horror, and these nations will serve the king of Babylon 70 years. Then it will be when 70 years are completed, I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation, declares the Lord, for their iniquity and the land of the Chaldeans, and I will make it an everlasting desolation. So Israel's in exile for 70 years. The 70 years is coming to an end. And here now in Daniel chapter 9, Daniel is praying for the will of the Lord concerning what the people of Israel should do. But notice also 2 Chronicles 36:21. The 70 years was to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah until the land has enjoyed its Sabbaths. All the days of its desolation, it kept Sabbath until 70 years were complete. So if we do the math, if Israel was sent into exile for 70 years for failing to keep the seventh year sabbatical, that would mean Israel had failed to keep the sabbatical for the previous 490 years, which meant from the very first king of Israel, the beginning of the theocracy. So do you catch what Daniel is being told here? There will be still another 490 years for the nation of Israel, just like there was in the past 490 years. And the phrase "the seal of visions and prophecies" means to complete all of the prophecies concerning Israel, hence the fulfillment of the coming Messiah and the Messianic kingdom. Verse 25, "So you are to know and discern that from the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. Now, this is the prophecy of the date when the Messiah would arrive. Now, most people know that the place where the Messiah would arrive was prophesied, Bethlehem, but few realize that the exact date was also prophesied. And that explains why there were so much messianic expectations in the days of Jesus. So if we do the math, 7 weeks and 62 weeks is 483 years. 7 years short of the 490-year period. The reason for the division of 49, 7 weeks, plus the 434, 62 weeks, is a whole other discussion that we don't have time for, but it's very clear that the Messiah would arrive 483 years after the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. Now, the decree of King Cyrus in 536 BC allowed the Jews to return to the land of Israel. And that was a big historical event. But it was not until about another 70 or 80 years later that King Darius of Persia actually decreed the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the temple in 457 BC. That's Ezra chapter 6, verse 8. Now, if the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem to the arrival of the Messiah would be 483 years, then 457 BC plus 483 years brings us to AD 26, which would not have been the birth of Jesus, but the commencement of his ministry, his public announcement that the kingdom of God had arrived. But the prophecy continues. Then after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. So here's the surprise every Orthodox Jew needs to accept. The prophecy is that the Messiah will be cut off. The word "cut off," karath, refers to a violent death, to be cut down. As in Genesis chapter 9, verse 11, those who died in the Noahic flood were cut down. Or Numbers chapter 11, verse 33, the Jews who ate the quail in the wilderness were cut down. And the Messiah will have nothing, meaning in Hebrew, that he will not have what is due him. Israel will reject him as their king. And this truth about the Messiah not being received by the Jews was so outside the expectation of the Jews that even Jesus' own disciples didn't anticipate the crucifixion, the cutting off of the Messiah. Why? Well, because there are so many other prophecies in the Old Testament about the victories of the Messiah. Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6, "There will be no end to the increase of his government." The contrary verses about the Messiah's death could not be explained, and so they were ignored. Well, the prophecy goes on to tell us that after the Messiah is cut off, Jerusalem and the temple will be destroyed. Then after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing, and the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary, and its end will come with a flood. Even to the end, there will be war. Desolations are determined. This is exactly what happened in AD 70, after the crucifixion of the Messiah, when the Romans destroyed Israel and deported all of the residents, as Jesus foretold in Luke chapter 19, verse 44, "And they will level you to the ground and your children within you, and they will not leave in you one stone upon another, because you did not recognize the time of your visitation. Also, Jesus said in Luke 21, but when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is near, because these are the days of vengeance, so that all things which are written will be fulfilled. Well, where were they written? Well, in the book of Daniel. And they will fall by the edge of the sword and will be led captive into all the nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Now, consider how this sounded to Daniel and the people living in Daniel's day. The temple is going to be rebuilt again, verse 25, but verse 26, it's going to be destroyed again. Well, that's depressing. The hope was that Israel would be back in the land for good, but another exile is being foretold here. As the prophet spoke of another exile and the second return from exile, that would be Isaiah 11:11, then it will happen on that day that the Lord will again recover the second time with his hand the remnant of his people. Now, the big question in verse 26 is, who are the people of the prince who is to come, who will destroy the city and the sanctuary? Is this speaking about the Romans, Nero, the Roman general Titus, who destroyed Jerusalem in AD 70? The only prince who is to come mentioned in this text is the Messiah, verse 25. And also, verse 24, the Jews are called the people. So this text may be saying that the Jews themselves are responsible for destroying Jerusalem. And it is true that the Jewish zealots had some moral responsibility in stirring up the Romans to destroy Jerusalem. But the standard evangelical interpretation is that the prince to come is Caesar and the Roman army, that fourth empire mentioned in Daniel chapter 7. But regardless of the interpretation, the results are the same. The end is going to come with a flood and wars and desolation. Then verse 27, he will make a firm covenant with many for 1 week, 7 years. And this is the missing 7 years in that 490-year total. The he could be referring to the Messiah. The Messiah reestablishes his covenant with Israel for the completion of the 490 years. And really, it's God who establishes covenants with Israel, not Satan, not the Romans, not some Antichrist, but God. But if we take the people of the prince to come to be Antichrist, the Roman revived empire, that fourth beast, this is how many prophetic teachers come up with the theory that the Antichrist will make a covenant of peace with Israel, and then in the middle of the week or in the middle of the 7 years, he will break that covenant. And this is probably true. That's something that the Antichrist will likely do. The point is, it just may not be definitive from this particular text. The other big question in verse 27 is in regard to he puts a stop to sacrifice in the middle of the week. There are two interpretations on this. First, the Messiah puts a stop to the sacrifices by his work on the cross. He does this in the middle of the week after 3.5 years. And from the time Jesus was baptized until the crucifixion was 3.5 years. Therefore, verse 27 is explaining that the 70th week of Daniel, that final 7 years, began when Jesus commenced his ministry. But the Messiah was cut off after 3.5 years. And then, when we go to the book of the Revelation, 7 years is never mentioned once. But the time frame is 3.5 years. It's actually mentioned 4 times in the book of the Revelation. Revelation chapter 11, verse 2. They will tread underfoot the holy city 42 months. I will grant authority to my 2 witnesses, and they will prophesy for 1,260 days, which is 3.5 years. Revelation 12, 6. The woman fled into the wilderness where she had a place prepared by God so that there she would be nourished for 1,260 days, another 3.5 years. And then Revelation 13, 5. and there was given to him, the Antichrist, a mouth speaking arrogant words of blasphemy and authority to act for 42 months, 3.5 years. So the 7-year tribulation talked about in the church might only be 3.5 years long. The other interpretation is that the entire 7 years is still in the future. The one who stops the sacrifice in a rebuilt temple is the Antichrist. And he does so in the middle of the 7-year apocalypse. The entire missing 7 years then is still in the future. And this interpretation associates the stopping of the sacrifice with the abomination, which Jesus said was future. And if you can determine conclusively which interpretation is correct, I think you will earn a doctorate in theology. But either way, regardless of which interpretation you take, the general prophetic outline doesn't change. The Messiah is cut off, the Jews experience another exile, then a return to the land, and a coming Antichrist who will destroy. One last question to answer. If the Jews were told that they only had 490 years to the end, how come over 2,000 years has passed? Well, there appears to be room for a gap in verse 27. After the Messiah is cut off, there is war and desolation. And the covenant has to be reestablished for the remaining 7 years. Yes, 490 years are decreed for God's intimate work with national Israel. But between the 483rd year and the final 7th year is the time of the Gentiles. And that is the gap that Jesus and Paul spoke about. Jesus made reference to this parenthesis, calling it the time of the Gentiles in Luke chapter 21. They, Israel, will fall by the edge of the sword, and they will be led captive into all of the nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. In Luke 21, Jesus then goes on to say that once the times of the Gentiles are completed, then the signs of the coming apocalypse will commence. The insertion of the Gentile church age between Israel's 483rd year and the final 7 years should not be considered an interpretive stretch of the imagination. Paul taught in his epistle that God's program for the Gentile church was not made known in previous generations. Ephesians chapter 3, verse 5. God doesn't have to tell us everything. And Paul also writes that a partial hardening has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles come in. Romans 11, 25. Partial in the sense that many Jews are Messianic Jews today. They believe in Jesus. But as far as the theocratic nation, it's been set aside. But Romans 11, 25 is really saying that once God has finished his work among the Gentiles, then God will restart the prophetic clock with national Israel, which is Matthew 24, 14. This gospel of the kingdom shall be preached to the whole world as a testimony to all the nations, and then the end will come. First must come the times of the Gentiles. Worldwide evangelism. So now Israel is back in the land. It's a nation once again. The fig tree is putting forth its leaves. I recently read an article by a Jewish rabbi. He writes, I recently met in Jerusalem with Professor Leon Lederman, Nobel Prize winning physicist. We were talking science, and as the conversation went on, I said, what about spirituality, Leon? And he said to me, Schroeder, I'll talk science with you, but as far as spirituality, speak to the people across the street, the theologians. But then he concluded and he said, but I do find something spooky about the people of Israel coming back to the land of Israel. Professor Lederman found nothing spooky about Eskimos eating fish at the Arctic Circle, and he found nothing spooky about Greeks eating moussaka in Athens. But he finds something really spooky about Jews eating falafel on Jaffa Street because it shouldn't have happened. It doesn't make sense historically that the Jews would come back to the land of Israel, yet that is what has happened. God's prophetic word will come true. Zechariah chapter 10, verse 8, I will whistle for them to gather them together, for I have redeemed them, and they will be as numerous as they were before. There will be an apocalypse. Jesus will return in glory, and there will be a heaven and a hell. So get with the program. Believe God's word and become obedient to the gospel of Jesus Christ so that you will be saved. Acts chapter 2, verse 39, for the promise is for you and your children and for all those who are far off and as many as God will call to himself. Pray that you'll hear the voice and the invitation of our Lord Jesus Christ. And I hope to see you in the kingdom of Christ. Thank you for making God and country a part of your discipleship in the word. May God richly bless you as you continue to live by the word of God.